to another episode of Your Average Critics, joined by Obi. How are you, Obes?
I'm swell. How are you?
Yeah, I'm neat. Thank you. So today it's just, you know, catching up on the films and TV that we've been watching over the last couple of weeks since Black Panther: Wakanda Forever. I think there's certainly, from the stuff that's out, it's kind of the, you know, the non-franchisey ones, the your dramas, your maybe a bit Oscar type films, just not the ones expected to dominate the box office like Black Panther. But as we always like to do, we always talk about Marvel, and there were a couple of trailers released in the last week, one of which was for Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3. This one starts off as, you know, in the normal kind of comic tone. I think they land on some planet which kind of looks like Earth but is inhabited by like weird aliens, and Drax assaults one of them essentially with a volleyball. And then the rest of it's kind of a bit more emotional. There's Rocket saying, you know, something about, we need to remember where we come from. There's a shot of him looking younger. There's a shot of a few of them anguished. So, yeah, how did this trailer make you feel in terms of how much you are looking forward or might have been to Volume 3?
I think it's a good trailer. I think a joke, like you said, a joke right at the start with both of Drax. We had a joke right at the start and a joke right at the end, both Drax related. So I enjoyed those. I think one thing I like about the Guardians films the most, and why I put the second one above the first one, is because of those like emotional beats. And I think they do try to play on that in this trailer. And to do about the music as well as kind of like what's happening in the scenes. You see like Peter's, like you say, Peter's in anguish, he's crying out about something. You see Rocket kind of like on some sort of examination table, maybe. You see, Mantis and Gamora, I believe, like carrying Drax out somewhere after seemingly he's been shot. I think you see Drax carrying Peter Quill, and he's like unconscious as well. And I think James Gunn made a big point about like how this is like the end of kind of this saga. Whether or not it's the end for these characters, I don't know. But I do get the feeling that after this film, we probably won't see a lot of these characters for a while. So I'm quite curious as to how they're going to handle it, and if we are actually going to have to say goodbye to some of these characters, or if it's just going to be a thing of like, oh, see you later, or are people in this film actually going to die? Because James Gunn himself makes a big point about how he wants his characters, when they die, to stay dead.
Okay.
So, yeah, I'm looking forward to it, to be honest with you. Again, I'm looking forward to that family aspect. I want to see how they kind of deal with the whole Gamora situation and how kind of what she's doing. I think there was rumours that she might be a Ravager now or something.
Yeah, and also, like you said, she's in the trailer, so there's not even like, will she be in it? It's, well, no, she's in it, but I was wondering with some of those shots whether they were from the past, like flashbacks. So whether it's when they first met, or I can't remember if they all initially meet in the first Guardians. I mean, I know they meet Quill, but some of them are already kind of together, aren't they? Like Rocket and Gamora?
Rocket and Groot.
Groot.
Know each other. I think the rest of them, I think, met in the first Guardians film.
Okay, so it's not likely.
But obviously Nebula and Gamora know each other, obviously, as well.
Yeah, okay, so that kind of puts that to bed then. So, I mean, it does look pretty good. We get a glimpse of Adam Warlock as well.
Yeah.
Played by... I can't remember his bloody name.
Will Poulter.
Will Poulter, that's it, thank you. Looking very golden. Basically, he just looks like a human painted in gold, which is, I guess, what the other high... I don't know what they were called, the other... regal-looking people. It looks pretty good. Who do you expect to survive, then? Or who do you expect for us to see moving forward, whether it's immediately or in the future?
Who do I expect us to see moving forward? So I feel like the trailer sets it up to make you think that Rocket will perish. So because of that, I think that Rocket will not. So I think Rocket will still be about. I think also... I think Mantis will still be about. Then the rest of them, I think Drax is probably going to die, or we won't see him again, because I think Dave Bautista's done with this role. He doesn't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
Chris Pratt, I could also see being kind of like, eh, I kind of like want to move on to like do other stuff.
Nah, he's a franchise whore.
Do you think?
Yeah.
Fair.
I could be very, very wrong, but I think he's the type of person who'll be like, yeah, I'm just going to carry on. Like, he was in the Jurassic Park films. He's now in, like, the Mario film, which we were just talking about the trailer for that. I think, I don't recall him coming out with anything kind of pissed off at Marvel when they fired James Gunn. But yeah, and I think, I don't know about Gamora, because Zoe Saldana's kind of come out and said that the last 10 years she's just been in franchises and she kind of wants to do something different. But I don't know whether that means... Well, because she signed up for I don't know how many Avatar films, so...
Well, I'll say she's got one of the best agents on the planet. but yeah, I could see her being like, do you know what, I'm okay. Like, I'm done with this kind of thing. To be honest, I wouldn't be surprised if we get a thing of, like, obviously, I assume Peter and Gamora reconcile at the end of this film, and then they just, you know, they piss off and say, oh, we're going to do whatever. And then those two can come back as and when, but maybe in Secret Wars or whatever, but for now, them just kind of being like, okay, yeah, we're done with it. And then I can see people like Rocket and Mantis and Nebula being a bit more... being a bit more present in the current MCU than those other two, and Groot obviously, because Groot's just, you know, Groot.
Yeah, although I kind of, they have already kind of killed off Groot, haven't they? Because this Groot, I think, is the spawn of the first Groot. Yeah. They just need to sack Vin Diesel. Like, genuinely, what is the point of having him as Groot? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not as if when he goes, oh, we are Groot, you're going, oh, it's Vin Diesel.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah.
Like, it doesn't make any financial sense to pay this guy any money at all to say, we are Groot or I am Groot. Like, I'll do it for you for a couple of bucks, mate. I don't care.
To be fair, well, we don't know. We could, because let's say he does get sacked and we see another Groot and all of a sudden we're like, oh, we missed the old Groot. You never know.
Maybe. I'll try and do my best Vin Diesel impression. Although he might have some time after Fast 11 comes out. Talking of the Guardians, like we can talk, I mean, we'll talk about the Ant-Man bit in a sec, but the Guardians of the Galaxy Holiday Special was a thing.
Yeah.
That happened the other week. So this was a 45-minute Marvel special in the same vein as Werewolf by Night. This was focusing on Christmas and how Drax and Mantis particularly wanted to give Peter a really special Christmas, as they believed that Yondu had ruined it for him when he was a child. So what they do is they decide to go down to Earth and kidnap Kevin Bacon, because Quill is very much into Footloose and Kevin Bacon. So they're like, oh, this is a good present. So there's, you know, a few shenanigans of them capturing Kevin Bacon and then essentially bringing him back to nowhere, which they have bought off the collector in the intervening time since we last saw them, which actually wasn't that long ago because it was Thor, Love and Thunder. But yeah, so I watched this. I laughed like a fair amount, but I came away with it thinking, what on earth was the point? Like, there's a couple of things that furthers the plot in the sense that they reveal Mantis to be Quill's sister, and that they've bought nowhere and there's Cosmo the Space Dog. But I was kind of like, it didn't really do anything for me. And I was just kind of like, it wasn't bad, but it wasn't good. And I mean, I don't really like Mantis as a character anyway. I think she's really annoying. So the fact that the main focus was Drax and Mantis kind of grated on me a bit. But I don't know. Did you feel more positively about it?
I'm in probably a fairly similar boat to you. I think that it was fine. It looked, for a TV budget, it looked okay. But obviously you can tell there's like a massive downgrade on the films, just like quality wise. Even just some looking at how Mantis looks, for example, she looks different than she looks in the films. And even Kraglin as well, like the arrow in his head looked a lot more like prosthetics than
Groot.
Yeah, Groot as well.
Ooh, I was like, now stick to CGI for that one, please.
Yeah, that wasn't the best.
Look in a fat suit.
I'm not sure how I feel about Musclehead Groot, to be fair. It is what it is, I guess. I think generally, it fulfilled its purpose, I guess, which I assume was just introducing certain things about certain characters and then kind of like telling a little side story, you know, about it kind of like, I suppose it kind of goes to further show kind of like Peter Quill and Yondu's relationship in the end. Kind of like still showing like Peter's connection to Earth, I suppose. It kind of like increases kind of, I suppose, the Guardians like bond as a family, the fact that they are what they want to kind of kidnap human beings in order to kind of like make Quill happy. You got obviously the revelation that Peter and Mantis are brother and sister, which is interesting. Obviously I didn't know that before, so that was a pretty cool fact. And even to us with Mantis kind of showing that she's actually very, very capable. She can fight and shit. Which I didn't know before. So I remember when we're in Endgame, when obviously all the women, all the women fighting scene come about, I remember thinking like, oh, what's Mantis going to do? What can she do? But actually shows that she can actually fight and stuff, which is cool, which I enjoyed, I guess. I am a bit more similar to you, whereas I feel like if they didn't bring this thing out, I don't think we would have particularly missed anything. The stuff that they did introduce probably could have been introduced in the Guardians 3 film.
Absolutely.
So would I say that this was necessary? No. But did it fulfill its purpose? I suppose yes, to a degree. I probably didn't laugh that much. I think I laughed maybe a couple of times, but nothing anywhere. No, nowhere near as much as I did with the first two Guardians films, personally. But I thought it was pretty average. All in all, it's not terrible. It's not fantastic. I think Werewolf by Night, although I think Overrated, is probably the better Marvel presentation of the two.
Yeah, because it's introducing us to a new kind of section of the Marvel mythology with like the kind of horror, spooky aspect. It did something kind of thematically different and introduced us new characters. So that, you know, that's what I see these special presentations as doing. Or filling a gap, but this, I don't feel like the holiday special was a gap that needed to be filled. But, you know, it's fine. Like, they did it. I just sort of thought, so have you heard about Disney CEO changing in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, I did hear about that.
So there was a guy called Bob Chapek who took over from Bob Iger in 2020, and Bob Iger has now returned to take over from Bob Chapek, which, you know, Bob Iger was initially in charge from 2005 to 2020, so 15 years. During that time, they bought, well, all of the MCU started, Disney Plus, D23, so some pretty big things that kind of happened during that time. The new Star Wars franchise, all of that sort of thing. So, I mean, I don't really know how much say someone like Bob Iger has or how much involved he gets or what the ramifications might be for this. There's people on Twitter who, you know, is not a very verifiable source of information, but suggesting that he's a bit more conservative in regards to like things like Daredevil being rated R than Chapek would be. Obviously, this is all speculation, but do you know anything about this, and what do you think might be the impact of particularly the MCU moving forward?
I don't really know much about it, to be honest, so I can't. I don't really have much grounds to say how I think it will move forward. I don't. I always would have imagined that creatively, you've got kind of like the heads of, so let's say Lucasfilm and Marvel, for example. You've got Feige and you've got what's her face, Kathleen Kennedy, who kind of work within. They have creative control, but obviously work within these certain guidelines. What those guidelines are, I think it's hard to say. I'm not really sure about kind of like how conservative they are and stuff like that. But I would have thought that obviously when you talk about like Daredevil and stuff like that, that being conservative, is Daredevil not, obviously, obviously Daredevil came out on like Netflix and stuff, but principally was it not, is it not still technically under, was it technically still under Disney at the time as well? Or is that not the case?
I'm not sure about that. I feel like it was a pretty Netflix thing. But like, you know, like we said, it's all speculation. Hopefully nothing like that changes because, you know, these things are already in production or starting production and, you know, thoughts are, you know, casting's happening and all that sort of thing. So, hopefully that doesn't change. But yeah, just worth flagging as some film news. And then there was a small bit of Ant-Man trailer, which was kind of just refreshing us on what's happened to Ant-Man in the franchise so far, shown at the Brazilian Comic Con. But there was a couple of little bits that were not present in the trailer, I think.
You'll have to remind me what those bits were, because I remember watching this trailer thinking, I've seen all of this before. So, yeah, I wasn't a big fan of that trailer. So, yeah, you have to remind me of what stuff.
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure either. Yeah. I remember watching it. I was like, maybe there's a small snippet. But I guess if anyone listening is more familiar with what might have been added, then do let us know. Twitter at YC Podcast 17 and Instagram, You Have to Critics, as usual. All right, well, any more film news?
There was a couple more trailers, wasn't there? There was trailers for Indiana Jones.
Oh, yeah.
5.
And The Dial of Destiny.
The Dial of Destiny. Saw a bit of de-aging technology for Harrison Ford there, which I thought looked okay.
I mean, considering Harrison Ford is in his, 80s?
Yeah, he's like literally 80, yeah.
They've de-aged him by almost half his life. It looked pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about, how I felt about the trailer in general. I mean, they all seem pretty much of a muchness, these Indiana Jones films. They don't necessarily hold a particularly kind of fond place in my heart.
I've actually never seen them.
Even though I've never seen the fourth one. I've seen the first three. And that, you know, they're just like adventure kind of films.
Yeah.
So yeah, this one just kind of looked similar. I guess there's a heavy dose of nostalgia. A few callbacks. It's got Phoebe Waller-Bridge in it as presumably a new sidekick. But yeah, I mean,
I think I'm quite interested in this one only because I think it seems as if Harrison Ford's really passionate about Indiana Jones franchise compared to like Star Wars. I think Star Wars, he's not like super bothered.
Yeah.
Indiana Jones, I think he has he said in an interview like he'll do it to the day he dies, basically. So I think he's really quite passionate about it. So I'm curious to see what story they put forth that had him say, okay, yeah, cool, I want to do this kind of thing. I think as well, like, I think just because obviously this is like, Indiana Jones is like one of like the most iconic like film franchises of, like, in history, I would say, probably. So I'm curious to kind of delve into them and see what the hype is, kind of thing, give them a watch. But yeah, I think the trailer itself, I say, was, like you say, as much of a muchness. Like, it was just pretty generic, I would say. There was the one joke at the end with him doing the whips and saying, get back, and they all just started shooting him. I thought that was quite funny.
Yeah.
because obviously, you know, that's like kind of putting like a modern day spin on kind of like the whole whip stuff. So that was pretty funny. So if there's jokes like that in it, I think I could get on board. I would say. So
I can imagine it will be absolutely fine. And it can't, you know, I've not seen the fourth one, but there was a lot of kind of ridicule from it because I think it had aliens in, and he survived a nuclear bomb in a fridge or something like that.
Mm.
So I have yet to see that one, but I would, you know, the first three are, you know, they're fun. They're kind of aimed at children, but they're also not, because there's some quite like, you know, scary moments in them for a predominantly children's film. And interestingly, in terms of like film censorship, I think at the time there was no PG-13, and it was put as a PG rather than a R. But I think after that point, they were like, we need something in between, because there's a scene where like one of these characters' faces melts. Which is rather violent for a kind of 8-year-old, I guess. One of the other trailers is, we mentioned it briefly earlier, the Super Mario Brothers movie, which features the voice casting of, among other people, Chris Pratt as Mario, but not as an Italian-American or an Italian Mario. It's Chris Pratt.
Yeah. I actually haven't seen this trailer, so you have to kind of tell me if it was good or not.
Okay, well, there's been two. The first trailer...
I saw the first one. It was kind of shit.
Okay. But, yeah. The first one was like Bowser going up to the penguins. I don't know what they were, and just melting them. And then you kind of very briefly see Mario, and he doesn't really say that much, but then Toad is there. This second one is a little bit more. This one was a bit more like iconography of the Mario franchise, if that makes sense. So there was like the carts. There's a bit more of Luigi. Peach as well. She seems to be playing like a big part in this. And there was the Yahoo moment for that Mario says, but again, just done in an American accent. I mean, I guess there's a chance that you can play onto harmful stereotypes if it was.
I was gonna say the same thing, because I think generally the Mario accent, the historic one, is built on a stereotype of an Italian. Like, it's kind of like a hokey, jokey version of Italian American. So I think you had two choices with this. You either pick someone who's like Italian and do the film in English, obviously, but with an Italian accent. But that's not iconic with Mario, that type of voice. Or you just do it in an American accent, and that's why Super Mario is. Actually, is Super Mario an American franchise, or is it Japanese or something?
Oh, it's a Nintendo, isn't it? So, presumably it's Japanese.
Right, okay, well...
But, I mean, I guess you could have just cast an American-Italian, even if they do their own American voice.
Yeah.
I don't think Chris Pratt is Italian-American.
No, I don't think so.
But anyway, you know, it's going to be one of those things that people will talk about, and it'll come out, and they'll be like, yeah, do you know what? Yeah. It is what it is. But his voice, he's done a lot of voiceover animation now, because he was in the Lego movie, and he did that Pixar film.
Onward,
that's it. Thank you. And he doesn't seem to kind of change his voice when he does it. So kind of like, I don't know if we mentioned this last time or if I was just thinking it in my head, but why do you really need big name actors to voice cast an animation? Like, can you not just pay, you know, get someone who's a voice actor? But like, I'm not watching the Super Mario Brothers film because Chris Pratt voicing Mario. Do you know what I mean? It's because it's a Super Mario film. So whether it was Chris Pratt or, you know, Joe Bloggs, like, that doesn't matter to me. And half the time, you know, they'll be like, oh yeah, is it Jack Black playing Bowser? I was like, well, I couldn't really tell that was his voice, so could have saved some money there, mate. But anyway, I think I'm just being facetious. But yeah, I mean, it looked fine. It was very much like, hey, oh, I recognise that from the games and Mario Kart and all these other Mario There's you know, they pick the flower and that gives them some sort of special power. So yeah, it was, you know, again, kind of playing on that nostalgia.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll go straight anyway.
I don't mind. I think video game adaptation film, well, to be honest, I'm trying to think of the last one, was Sonic, I suppose, and I enjoyed the Sonic films, but I suppose they are slightly different than this in that I think this one doesn't have, like, real people in it. It's all just characters.
Yeah, I think it's Illumination who did the Despicable Me franchise.
Yeah. I'll give it a shot. I've never been the biggest Super Mario fan. I played the games a couple of times maybe, but I wasn't like a big like Mario Kart person. But you know, I'll watch anything, so I'll give it a try.
There's a video game adaptation of The Last of Us, which I've not played, but that's quite a renowned video game. That's coming out on HBO next year, yeah. I think.
Yeah, there's a trailer that came out yesterday. I haven't watched it yet, though. But I've seen that Pedro Pascal's in it, so I'll probably give it a try.
Mm-hmm. And Bella Ramsey, who was in Game of Thrones. She was Lyra Mormont.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I do wonder about, because I know the game IP is very popular, but then I'm always thinking, like, this is another, like, zombie franchise type thing. And I wonder if people are still interested in zombie stories. So I'm quite curious to see how people kind of like how non-game players will kind of like receive this show and kind of if it will be popular amongst them people. Because I know people, you know, there's The Walking Dead, there's iZombie, there's, you know, I think quite a few other zombie type stuff. So which I felt like kind of died out a few years ago. So I'm curious to see what kind of like if they kind of are able to do something different with it, with the story, or at least maybe write it well enough so that you can still use those generic story beats when it comes to zombie stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, agreed. I'm sure we'll talk about that if it comes out, if it's popular enough. On TV, the Disney Plus show Andor finished since we last spoke. I think did we speak about episode 11? On the last pod, or was it episode 10?
I'm trying to remember what happened in episode 11.
Episode 11 was when Marva dies.
We did speak about that.
And then Mon Mothma was kind of leaning more towards like marrying her daughter off to end her financial woes.
We didn't speak about that.
Okay, so I think the last thing we spoke about was Andor getting out of prison. Then episode 11, Marva passes away, which we kind of, I think we theorized would happen anyway, but I think we kind of thought maybe it wouldn't be of natural causes. It would be like, it would spur Cassian on to do something, which I guess it kind of serves that purpose here. But yeah, so she passes away, and then Mon is looking to marry her daughter off. Saw Gerrera and Luthen kind of argue because there's a guy called Krieger who works for Luthen, and they're kind of using him as a sacrificial lamb because the ISB know about their plans for him and to make sure that their kind of internal spy doesn't get found out and to kind of, I guess, give them a little bit so that they don't focus on the rest of it. I don't even think we've actually seen this Krieger guy. So
no.
They've spoken about him quite a lot and he gets sacrificed. So I guess, again, this show is all about like making you as an audience appreciate that you're only seeing a very small snippet of a larger picture. That Luthen is clearly puppeteering quite a lot of different things. And, you know, we're talking about this Krieger guy. We know quite a lot about the plan and that he's going to be sacrificed, but we never see any of that happen. We don't meet him, but we know that he was kind of sacrificed for the greater good. Cassian finds out at the end of the episode that Marva has died, and so he then heads back to Ferrix, I think it's Ferrix, to attend the funeral. And at this point, the ISB officer are kind of saying, you know, let's give them the permit for the funeral. Let's, you know, try and draw Cassian back to Ferrix to kind of capture him. Then episode 12 is the penultimate.
Episode 11, we've got a pretty sick space battle, I felt like, with Lufen and the ISB people. That was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, they tried to onboard him, didn't they? And he was, like, stalling, and then he goes space mode.
Yeah, that fucking lightsaber's popping out of his ship. It was pretty cool. So
yeah. He's such an enigma of a character. I'm like, you're the good guy, but you're also very ruthless.
Yeah, part of me thought he was a fucking Jedi, to be honest with you. Like, just the way he moves so mysteriously, it made me think that he was, like, either a former Jedi or a former Sith. But obviously, I don't think he is now, but I don't know. I just can't figure him out. I can't work.
And he always wears that hood, doesn't he? Hood, and you're like, oh, all the Siths wear hoods.
Yeah.
On that, in film and TV, everyone either puts on a baseball cap or puts their hood up to act, like, inconspicuous. But I'm sorry, if no one else is wearing that, then you're actually more conspicuous.
It's a fair point.
Anyway.
It's a fair point.
Yeah, that's one of those, like, little annoyances that I see all the time. So in the final episode, Cassian returns to Ferrix for a funeral. He learns that Bix is in prison. He ends up rescuing her. Mon Mothma's daughter is introduced to her betrothed. Then the funeral happens, and it's kind of drawn out. There's the bands that play, and I can't remember, like, the tune of it, but that tune that they play, the kind of funeral march, was really effective. It was a really good piece of music. You're more of the, you know, score guy, but I really appreciated that, and I thought it was a really rousing kind of tune. Mm. And then you've got, like, all the ISB officers trying to coordinate, like, trying to all different pockets of people all over Ferrix. You've also got Vel and her partner. I'm so terrible with these names.
Cinta.
What's her name?
Cinta.
Cinta. Okay, cool. Yeah, so they're trying to find Cassian. Everyone's trying to find Cassian. Cyril's there, trying to save Miro. But there's a part where he saves her, and I thought they're going to kiss. I was like, please don't kiss.
That was... they're a pair of freaks, mate. That was getting hot and heavy. I thought fucking...
Yeah. My guy Cyril. And then at the end of the funeral, there's a recording of Marva, like a hologram, and she literally, like, you know, rallies the people against the Empire. She's like inciting the rebellion, essentially. Mm. And there's a bit where she says, fight the Empire, but apparently they wanted to say fuck the Empire, but Disney wouldn't allow them.
Really?
Yeah.
I wouldn't have liked that, to be fair. I'm glad they didn't say that. That is a very Star Wars to me.
And then as soon as she finishes, the ISB cut her off, and then there's, like, a riot, and then one of the blokes uses her funeral brick to, like...
Yeah, I love that guy, mate. Brassa, I think, is his name. Yeah, he smashed her right in the head with the brick. Oh, I thought that was so funny.
But that's her brick. That's her. Like, he's just fighting everyone with this brick.
And that kid fucking threw a bomb.
Yeah. Oh my god. So yeah, so the rebellion is pretty much at the end of this episode, it's there. People are rallied to that cause. Cassian escapes, gets Bix out. He kind of figures out that Luthen wanted him dead, so presents himself to Luthen and is like, either I join you or you kill me. And then it's kind of suggested that Luthen asks him to join them. And then the post credit scene shows that what the prisoners were producing on Narkina 5 actually was parts of the Death Star. Mm. So I guess it kind of puts that even more into perspective from Rogue One, when, you know, they're there finding the plans, trying to get the Death Star destroyed. See, I thought that was a really kind of... It was a very short scene, but it was like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
You know. It was a really good episode, a really good series as a whole. I mean, how did it leave you feeling?
Yeah, man, I'm on the same boat as you. I think, like, this series' strength has always been in its writing. And I've literally just, like, quickly looked up Marva's speech from the funeral. And also, just Funnily, I didn't know her. So I don't know why. I just thought Cassian's. I didn't know her last name was Andor. I just think it's really cute that Cassian took her last name. But yeah. And she said the bit that got me was when she says near the end, she says, "The Empire is a disease that thrives in darkness. It's never more alive than when we sleep. It's easy for the dead to tell you to fight, and maybe it's true, but maybe fighting is useless. Perhaps it's too late. But I'll tell you this, if I could do it again, I'd wake up early and been fighting these bastards from the start, fight the Empire." And then I was like, and then they knocked over B2 Emo, because he's trying to stop the hologram from going. And then I feel like that was everyone's last straw. It was like, you can fucking shout at us, but you can't fucking attack our droids. And then obviously they're going crazy. Obviously, meanwhile, all this is happening, you've got Cassian, making his way around Ferrix, kind of looking for Bix and trying to get Bix out of her whole situation. And I think, I think it was this episode, or maybe it was episode 11, where they show the flashbacks of Cassian and Clem. And I think it's Clem showing Cassian, he's cleaning off some old weaponry, like that.
Yeah.
And he's saying, they kind of look at this stuff and they will throw it away. They won't even think about how we can how this can be reused and stuff like that, and kind of thinks of how maybe the Empire view all of these people that they're kind of using to build the Death Star or do whatever. They're just using them until they think that they're useless, and then when they think that they're useless, they completely disregard them, not thinking about the fact that these people can be useful in ways unimaginable to them, rising up against the Empire and stuff like that. I thought that kind of underlying message was really important and kind of quite key in Cassian's kind of development as a character. And even he read Nemec's manifesto, which we got a few more lines from that, which was cool as well. And then obviously him kind of hearing more of his speech I feel has now maybe he might not even be fully in, but I feel by the end of the episode, he is now thinking, right, we have to fight the Empire, sort of thing. I did think it was interesting that he didn't mention to anybody about what happened on Narkeena 5, because in episode 11, it was him and Melshi who were saying, we have to separate, people have to know about this kind of thing, because what if we're the only two people who made it out off the island? So I'm curious to know if he brings that up in season 2, or if we see Melshi again and we find out that he's kind of brought it up and kind of let people know what the Empire were doing and how fucked up it was. But yeah, the episode as a whole, I thought the build up, the build up, the music, the kind of setting the scene for that funeral, and even just showing things, I just love showing things like that, to do with culture and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And how the people of Ferrix kind of honor their dead, I think is really cool. And I think the Empire said they could only have 40 people, but in the end it was everybody showed up kind of thing, because in the end you can't stop them kind of thing. And then obviously everything breaking out into a fight, I thought that was pretty cool. That was really tense when the Geezer kicked the stormtrooper off the bell tower. I thought that was bare funny. and then you've got Deirdre, when she, I thought she was going to die. I thought they were going to kill her, to be fair. So when what's his face come along and saved her, those pair of freaks, they were I thought they were about to start getting off, to be fair. And I honestly don't know what that relationship is. Is it sexual? Is it not sexual?
He's kind of obsessed with her, but yeah, she's a bit, I don't really know. It is weird.
I imagine as in season 2, as being thankful for his loyalty, she might give him a position higher up than what he's currently got kind of thing. But yeah, I'm curious to see how that relationship develops as well. I think with Luthen, it's quite cool to see at the end when he goes back to the ship and you see that Cassian's got the jump on him already, and he was kind of either kill me or take me in. I'm assuming him saying take me in means make me part of the rebellion kind of thing, I assume.
Yeah, that's what I got from it.
Yeah, which is cool, because obviously now it shows that Cassian's kind of properly part of this fight now. So I'm interested in seeing how that develops into season two as well. I think the Mon Mothma stuff, to be honest, if I'm going to be completely honest, her daughter is an arsehole. So I'm not like completely like, I was already all the way on in like, yeah, betroth her, man. Fuck your daughter. She's a dickhead. So she's an arsehole. I'm sorry. She's an arsehole. And so is the husband. So
yeah, well, there's that thing where I wasn't sure whether, so Mon Mothma knows that her driver is spying on her.
Yeah.
And then she kind of formulates this argument in the back of the car with her husband, sort of be like, oh, you're financially ruining us or something. And I kind of wasn't sure whether she fabricated that to give false information to the driver.
I think she did, yeah, to throw him off the scent. So when they look at her accounts and they see 400,000 or 400 million missing, they say, okay, it's the gambling debts rather than her taking that money for the rebellion, I presume. Very clever, I thought, anyway. And even the husband's a dickhead as well, so yeah, he can go to hell for all I care.
Do you think Cassian remembers he's got a sister?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, that is a thread that if we don't readdress that at some point, I will be annoyed. Because what's the point in it otherwise?
Because they knew already that this was going to be two seasons and done. They knew it was going to be 24 episodes. That's it. So why, for an episode and a half, did you have him looking for her?
Mm.
And then, like, they must have planned this all out. You don't just add that in and forget about it. So maybe it comes back in season two, but the fact that it was, like, the first two episodes, and it's not been mentioned, I don't think, at all since then, it's kind of like, yeah, they should have just thrown in a couple of flashbacks or just a couple of lines here and there. For him to be like, oh yeah, I still need to, you know, I'm not going to join the rebellion at the moment because I need to find my sister first or something like that, you know, like, then that's all you need. But now we're sitting here going, what was the point of that?
Yeah.
But overall, I might even say this is better than The Mandalorian.
Oof. I hear it. I'm not sure if I agree, but I hear it.
Yeah, it's close anyway.
Definitely close.
So when season three of The Mandalorian comes out in March, then maybe that can convince me it's that. But yeah, very, very pleased with Andor as the TV show overall. So yeah, that was very good. On to film. We've both seen The Menu and She Said. What do you want to start with?
We can start with The Menu.
Okay, do you want to give us a synopsis?
So The Menu is a story about a group of people who go to this prestigious restaurant, like super prestigious restaurant on an island, and they kind of like go through various courses of a meal with a somewhat ridiculously unhinged head chef and his brainwashed sous chefs, or I don't know what they call the assistant chefs, as he somehow attempts to I'm trying to think of the right words, restore purity in like the food industry through murdering various people and himself.
Yeah, essentially, the head chef was just, he brought together this group of people that have had some say in his career and what he sees as the downfall of, like, high cuisine. Whether it's, you know, a food critic that causes certain restaurants to close because, you know, of her comments, or the tech bros who, like, he needed their company to bail him out, I think, during COVID, I think they said. Or there's the, like, Nicholas Holt's character, Tyler. He's a fanboy. He's obsessed with the Chef Julian's work, but he's actually not able to produce anything vaguely edible when, you know, he can say, oh, you've used this, this is bergamot, you've used this technique or whatever. But the when chef goes, all right, make me something, he just doesn't know how to do it. And so he sees that as like, well, you know, it's all superficial. Yeah, and like you said, he's kind of at the nadir of his kind of tether and just kills everyone. Yeah. But yeah, that obviously isn't apparent from the beginning. It kind of starts off very much in the, yeah, the high cuisine, all the kind of pretentious dishes, and it's presented like we're supposed to think this is ridiculous. There's like a tongue-in-cheek nature of it. And slowly but surely, as each course progresses, it gets a bit more dark. There's a course, one of the chefs, I can't remember his name, it's called, is it Jeremy? It's like Jeremy's Mess, and he ends up just shooting himself in the head.
Mm.
And it's like, oh, that's the part of your course. I think that it was interesting that Anya Taylor-Joy's character, Margot, is like the variable that he can't control, the chef. So he's like, oh, you're not supposed to be here. This is not part of the plan. And she's the only one that ends up surviving because essentially she has no time for the bullshit. And I think kind of ends up reminding the chef what he loved about cooking in the first place. The simplicity of a cheeseburger with fries.
Yeah.
And he allows her to survive. But what did you think of the film?
I'm mixed on it, to be honest. I think the premise is good and interesting. I think the film itself is pretty compelling as well. I was definitely engaged for the majority of it. But I just think when you peel back the layers and you just think about what's happening in the film, I think it just doesn't really make any fucking sense. Like, when you get to... So the things, there's a couple, just two key things to me that were just like, I'm just like, okay, I can't get on board with this because this doesn't make sense. Is one, the chef. I think his reasoning for killing these people is so, I think, paper thin. And like,
yeah, I agree.
Why these people? Why not, you know, the people who visited you last week? Like, why these people in particular? What are these people? Why? I'm sure, so there was the old couple who he was like, oh, you've been to my restaurant 11 times and you can't remember what you ate. Like, I'm sure there's plenty of people like that. Like, why them? Why them in particular? Like, to me, that didn't seem particularly fair. Why did you kill the guy who was bankrolling it during COVID? Like, what the fuck did he do wrong? Because he suggested changes to the menu? That means you should kill him. I just thought, like, stuff like that, to me, I was just like, and even the killing the actor because you didn't like his film or something like that, like, I was just
yeah,
like,
he said
what?
He was a sellout. Yeah. And also, his assistant, like, what did she do wrong?
Yeah. Like, come on,
like,
man.
There was, like, the tech bros, you're like, oh, you're pricks. Like, you can kind of see why, in a film context, someone would be like, oh, you know, you deserve to die for that or whatever. Yeah. But, and Nicholas Holt's character, Tyler, is a prick, but you only find that out afterwards when it's revealed that he knew. And this is also, for me, the main thing that doesn't make sense. Is Tyler knew that he was going to die.
Yeah.
And he was like still so happy about it, but we don't ever find the motivation for why, you know, is the motivation for him still going there just the fact that he wanted to try this bloke's food? Because yeah. If that's so, then that doesn't make any sense either, because we don't know Tyler as a character well enough to be like, oh yeah, this makes sense for this guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's paid, what did he say, is it $1,250 per person?
Yeah.
And was willing to essentially have this prostitute die just for no reason.
I mean in agreement with you, like, when you just think about, when you obviously, I get, you know, willing suspension of disbelief and all that, but when you just really think about it, like, when you think about it from supposedly a kind of like a more realistic real world perspective, like, would, do we know this person who would willingly, you know, commit himself and a stranger basically to death over some food? Like, I don't know, man. And even all the chefs, all of the sous chefs, they're all comfortable with killing these people and killing themselves. I find that so hard to believe, I'm sorry. Like,
yeah.
And even the suicidal, like, the his like under whose direct like report basically, the woman, Asian woman who died. She was just a fucking mental case. And she, from when she whispered in one of the douchebags' ears, she was like, you'll eat more than you deserve. And oh, I can't remember what she said, but she said some line or another.
You'll eat less like, than you want, but more than you deserve. Or
that's
something.
The one, yeah. I was like, if I was the guy, I'd be like, who the fuck are you to say that to me? What the fuck?
She was hilarious, though. Her, like, passive aggressiveness was so funny.
But yeah, I just
like something like that, and be like, is there anything else I can help you with? It's a pleasure, you know.
Yeah. I just struggled to believe that that many people would be okay with a mass suicide. That many people who are also happen to be super talented chefs. Because obviously you could go to like a mental institution and find, I imagine, and find loads of people who are suicidal and stuff like that and willing to do whatever. But to do that and also have people who are, you know, presumably very, very talented chefs and at least or well enough hinged in the mind to be able to do that to a good, to a very high standard, presumably, who are also okay with group suicide. I find that very, very, very hard to believe. But putting that aside, I thought that kind of like the actual, the way the story was told and like the progressing of the different courses and kind of like how each one got a bit more fucked up and stuff like that, I thought was interesting. And I enjoyed, I thought the acting was good as well for the most part. And like, even like the little twists of, well, the little twist obviously of, you know, finding out the whole, his whole plot, the twist of kind of like the guy, who came to rescue them from the boat and he was in on it and all stuff like that.
Oh yes.
Was cool as well. Yeah, it was fine. But yeah, I had a big problem with
it. It didn't really commit to a genre in the sense of like, it could quite easily have been a horror film and there was definite elements of that, but it didn't fully commit to it. It didn't really fully commit to it being a thriller. Mm. And there's obviously a massive element of social satire, which is probably the most thing it committed to most. I think, ironically, the film is kind of like the food that it portrays. It's like, it looks great, and on paper, you're like, yeah, this is good. And then the more you dig away, you're like, this is just superficial and actually kind of meaningless.
Mm.
But yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it for what it was.
Yeah. It just kind of made me think as well, like, I don't know if you remember, in so it's kind of random, but in New Mutants, did Anya Taylor-Joy's character survive? Do you remember?
I'm going to quickly try and find out for you. Why? What's your hypothesis?
No, I'm just saying, her characters always survive. I'm just thinking about this, I'm thinking about Split, I'm thinking about New Mutants. But I just feel like she's just like, I don't know, she's always, like, if she's in a film, like, similar to that, I'm always thinking, okay, yeah, she's going to make it out. She always seems to make it out.
She's the anti-Sean Bean.
Yeah, literally. But yeah. And also, she's got a bare small mouth. Makes me uncomfortable. What should I eat that burger? Make me feel bare uncomfortable.
I think she does. She goes to limbo. I think that's what it's saying here. Yeah. What would you give it out of 10?
Do you know, because I would say I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it, but obviously it just kind of didn't make that much sense to me. So I probably, and like, I was debating whether or not to actually go to the cinema to go see it. But then when I started watching, I was like, oh, actually, I'm glad I did see it, even though I didn't like love it or anything. So I'd probably give it like a 6.5.
Okay. I think I might have gone 7 on Instagram, but I can't remember. She Said is another latest release in the cinema. It's a biographical drama about the New York Times article that essentially helped expose Harvey Weinstein's long-standing sexual misconduct in Hollywood. So it starts with what is essentially a flashback of a woman on a film set and then cuts to her running away, kind of upset. Then there's an article about Donald Trump and some of the misconduct that he was accused of, but then he got elected president anyway. And then it kind of, the rest of the film just charts the journalists, Megan Toohey, played by Carey Mulligan, and Jodie Cantor, played by Zoe Kazan, as they essentially try to convince predominantly women, but also some men who were in kind of high-powered positions within Miramax at the time, to go on the record about, you know, what Harvey Weinstein did. And, you know, it's initially very difficult for them. There's people like Rose McGowan, who's, you know, a real-life actress that spoke out but wasn't believed, or, you know, it wasn't kind of taken anywhere. And there's been a kind of appetite, not an appetite to speak out anymore because it doesn't go anywhere or it affects their careers. And so, you know, it's very much charting just that journalistic process. We do get, you know, a bit of their, that these journalists' private lives and kind of how it affects them. You know, they're typical in these films, kind of like reminding me of Suits, where they're just working all day, every day. Like, they're always on call, always just in the office. And, like, it kind of... Although, actually, what I appreciated about this film is there weren't really any scenes where the partner was like, oh, you need to stop doing this, it's affecting our marriage. Like, they just seem to be like, yeah, this is your career and we support you with it. Which I kind of appreciated. That was, to me, stood out as different to what most of these types of films end up being. But yeah, so eventually some of the women are brave enough to come forward. There's Ashley Judd, who is an actress and actually plays herself in this, who, you know, was one of the first women to speak out and puts her name on the record in this article. And, you know, we kind of see the back of what's supposed to be Harvey Weinstein as he comes into the office, and we hear him kind of, you know, someone playing his voice on like speakerphone, and he's like, who have you spoken to? And he seems obsessed with like, have you spoken to Gwyneth Paltrow? You know, she's lying. And it's like, no, we're not including Gwyneth in the article, which I think is something I'd like to look into a bit more, actually. But yeah, so there's someone else called Laura Madden, who's a British woman, and she goes on the record as well. And it finishes, the film ends with them pressing publish on the article. And then there's the usual, as is common with these biographical films, it's like, give you a actually quite short text of just saying, since the article came out in 2017, 82 women came forward with allegations against Weinstein, you know, workplace and legal reforms, and that he's serving 23-year sentence for rape and sexual assault, with other charges being brought in different locations. So I quite like these journalism films, I've realised, about kind of real events. So Spotlight, there was one a few years ago, Bombshell, which was a thematically similar, about the Fox allegations. There was also, is it Dark Waters, about the...
Yeah.
That was, I think that was Mark Ruffalo. Yeah, so those, I quite like these sorts of films.
What was the one with Margot Robbie in it called? Sorry.
Is that, sorry?
The one with Margot Robbie.
Bombshell.
Bombshell, that's the one. Sorry, continue.
Yeah, so I quite like these films. So I knew, you know, at the very least, it'd be up my street. And I think there's a lot that this film does well, in the sense of, like, you know, showing the process. You know, as a audience member, even though I kind of know what's happened with Weinstein, I was getting frustrated as well, in a sense of, like, yeah, I understand why you don't want to come forward. Mm. And but it's also frustrating, because if you don't, then you're not going to be able to get change out of it, and just like hearing some of the horrific things that these women had subject to, and like the silence that they were paid with, and so that was all really good. What I kind of left feeling was that the film's too focused on getting the story, and there wasn't much more considered. So it was like, the film ends with the article published, great success. It's not, though, is it? Because he wasn't convicted for a while after that, and he's still awaiting charges elsewhere. For the victims, their ordeal didn't end when the article was published. It actually probably ended up being the beginning of another part of their journey. And there were just other things that, like, I would have liked, and this is idealistic, but I would have liked a bit more of the finance guy when the journalists go to his house and they're like, oh, didn't you approve all of these settlements? Like, what's the... We get a bit of impact on these people's lives, but actually what was, you know, I wanted a bit more about how it's really affected them. So I think the focus was quite narrow. But overall, obviously, I think I was entertained, I guess is a weird way of putting it. But I found it compelling. How did you feel?
So I think, to be completely honest, I don't think I was that entertained. I think that the subject matter, super important, and it actually kind of, so I think in the past I've been quite, not dismissive, but I think I've definitely been quite insensitive to kind of like, even on this podcast, to be fair, to the sort of, maybe atmosphere that like those women kind of were subjected to, and kind of like the pressure you might feel to kind of do or say certain things whilst in the presence of somebody who's that powerful. I think in the past I've definitely been very, as a man, kind of been very like, oh, you know, it's not that big a deal, blah, 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 just say no, blah, 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 blah. But kind of forgetting that, like, you know, I'm not the same as kind of like these women, and also I've not ever been put in that position these women have been put in. So I think I'm definitely much, much more sympathetic to kind of like their struggles and kind of everything they went through during and obviously after, kind of like the ones who struggled to kind of get work, and obviously people, ones who probably struggled mentally as well, after kind of going through these ordeals with someone like Harvey Weinstein, and obviously other people in that space who've kind of committed these sorts of kind of like crimes and stuff. So I think the film did well for me to kind of like definitely sympathize and kind of be more understanding of kind of like that and what's going on, and be more sympathetic for sure. But I don't think I found it super entertaining. I think the beginning I did find entertaining, but I think from the middle toward the end, I think it dragged a tad, and I wasn't super engaged. I think I think me personally, I was a little bit confused. Maybe not confused, but I was a bit like, okay, so who's this woman we're interviewing now? Okay, so who are we looking after? I think we could have done to maybe get some like a little subtitle underneath to say, just so I know maybe who is this woman that they are going to see, and kind of like what, how they connected to Harvey Weinstein, and kind of like what they maybe were accusing him of, I think would have been a bit helpful for me to kind of like be able to connect the dots a bit better, because I got a tiny bit lost.
Yeah, I see that, yeah.
And then there was also a couple of moments where they were doing like flashbacks, and I wasn't really following what was happening or how it was connecting to the story. I think particularly with can't remember her name, the Asian woman. I'm sure they flashback to her in like maybe a hotel room in Hong Kong, and I was like, how is this relevant to what's going on in the story right now? And I find that a bit confusing, I suppose. But
yeah, they did it for some, but not all of it.
Yeah, yeah. And I thought that was a strange avenue to go down. But I thought that the actual story, everything that was going on behind it, I found interesting. Obviously, a lot of stuff that I didn't know about. And even, like you say, seeing kind of like how much time and effort and trial and error will go into kind of like having to break these stories, and the amount of people who have to stay silent in order for something like this not to break out is probably more than we would even imagine.
Oh yeah, because some of these women were saying, like, I told my agent, I told some of the directors or whoever, and you know, yeah, there's a lot of people that must have known about it, and even some of the stories of people are essentially getting warned of like, oh yeah, wear two pairs of tights. Like, what? That's insane.
Yeah.
So that the blasé nature of it, yeah, just wear two pairs of tights, it makes it harder for him to assault you. Like, what?
Like, it's insane. Like, and I think, like, honestly, this is like, I don't know, you know, saying water is water, but like, it's so fucking hard to be a woman, Like, it's actually so fucking hard. Like, they have to go through so, just generally. Like, and I think, like, even not to be kind of like, not to be kind of pedantic or condescending in any way, because I'm not trying to be, but I just feel like if you ask me to be like a woman for like a week, I don't think I'd be able to do it. I think I'd lose my mind, to be honest. And it kind of like reminds me of like, do you remember in She-Hulk? I think it's maybe like the first episode where she kind of like is talking about like how she kind of always has to keep her cool, because if all of the stuff that kind of she goes through in her life, if she kind of like voiced how angry she was about it like all the time, she'd lose her fucking mind. And like, it just makes me think about that. Like, women can't even like go to work in peace. They can't progress their career in certain industries without kind of having to maybe do all of these things, that these heinous things, kind of thing. And it's just like, it's really horrible to see. And I would hope that kind of like this film, well, the whole Me Too movement has kind of made those moments or those kind of acts less so. Probably, I imagine, almost definitely still goes on, but hopefully we are progressing more towards those kind of like being eradicated completely. I mean, probably wishful thinking, but you know, you'd hope so. So I think the message of obviously the film and the kind of showing the history behind it, I think is definitely, it's definitely important and definitely well done in that case. But I don't know, it was for me, there was just a couple of things where I'm like, I'm actually, I don't know, getting a bit bored to be honest.
Yeah, no, fair enough. It's not done that well financially. It's expected to lose a fair amount of money.
Do films like this ever do well financially?
It's a good question. I feel like they maybe were hoping it would be like awards contendery, but I don't think it is.
No, I don't think it's either, really. I think the acting in it is fine, but I don't think it's anything to write home about.
No. I feel like that it would have been nice for them to use Ashley Judd a bit more, actually, as well. Like, she is there in very brief moments, but actually, considering she's playing herself, she plays quite a key part in it. Like, just a bit more understanding of actually how it's affected her. But yeah, so yeah, important film. If you like the subgenre of like journalism biopics, then it might be for you. From the serious to the ridiculous, I guess. Do you want to talk us through the film, the second film we were talking about today, which features John Leguizamo, Violent Night?
Yeah, Violent Night is.
Can you not do spoilers, please? Because I would hope to see it next week.
Violent Night is a film. I suppose it's kind of like, I kind of put it in the category of like a nobody, where it's like, what if John Wick but Christmas? So like, it's about like a Santa Claus who's obviously in this film, Santa Claus is real, and he basically has to defend this rich family from thieves who are trying to steal their fortune. And it's kind of, I suppose, about people believing in like Christmas and believing in Santa and kind of like keeping their belief. I suppose there's a bit of a mixture in there of kind of like there's a couple of family dynamics in there, although I think not very well explored. And then there's, I suppose, an aspect of kind of like David Harbour's Santa kind of being hardened over the years of kind of like going through being Santa for so long and so long, and they kind of go through his backstory, but they don't really delve into it deep enough. I actually found when they go into his backstory, it looked quite interesting, but they do it for like maybe they like flash past it so quickly, and it's actually like, oh, I really would like to know kind of like more about him and how like he kind of developed this mindset and kind of like how he does all the Santa stuff. You've got some pretty cool action scenes. There's like a play on like a Home Alone sort of vibe, but definitely way more violent.
Okay.
Which I think was pretty funny at times, and obviously pretty cool. What lets the film down, I think, is some of the characters. I think what was the guy's name again? John.
I think it's Leguizamo.
John Leguizamo. He's good. I like him actually. I think he's good in it. He's a good villain. His reasoning behind why I suppose he has a certain attitude towards Christmas is a good one, and I enjoy that. But then obviously David Harbour as Santa is good for the most part. But then I think there is an element of let's make this like super masculine film, macho, like dads are gonna like this, let's all laugh at this because it's our type of male humour, which I think doesn't quite, it comes off kind of lame in my opinion and doesn't quite work. And then you've got like the family, the rich family, who I think apart from the little girl who's kind of like who obviously like super believes in Santa, apart from the little girl and her mum, who are fairly normal, I feel like everyone else is like maybe four other family members, including like the matriarch of the family. They're all quite not deplorable, but like I just think they're all assholes. So like when they're in danger, they're being held hostage for this ransom, and I'm like, well, like why have you like why should I care about whether or not you guys live or die kind of thing? Like it doesn't really, I just like you've not shown me anything that makes me think, oh okay, you've endeared me kind of. I mean, you've been endeared to this family, and like I just didn't really care.
So you're not like particularly bothered whether Santa saves them.
No, not at all. Only, yeah, I cared about if he saved the little girl. I mean, and that's about it really, to be honest. Everyone else, I was like, eh. And then one of like the main catalysts of the film, which is why the bad guy starts getting a bit more violent, I suppose. One of the characters who did it, who kind of like caused it, you'll understand I think more when you see it, but like there's a thing that this character does that I'm like, why did you do that one, and why did you do it the way you did it? It just doesn't seem smart, but okay. You'll understand more when you watch it. There's one very quite jokes action scene with Santa and the sledgehammer where he just is like mowing people down with a sledgehammer, and that was pretty jokes. But then there was a lot of the time where I'm like, you guys have guns. Use your guns. And Santa's not
even... Presumably Santa can't die.
No, he bleeds. Bleeds a lot. Really? Yeah, he bleeds a lot. So presumably he can die. But yeah, they're just not using their guns.
okay.
But it's a fun time. I don't think it's a particularly good film. I think this would have been a very good Netflix type film.
Right.
So if I was talking to, obviously not you because you have a limitless pass, but if I was talking to a random person, I would say this isn't exactly going to be, you know, like a Christmas classic or anything like that, but it'd be a nice way to, you know, pass an hour 45 on Netflix kind of thing. But I suppose again, because they kind of have like a more adult take on the Christmas film, I suppose, which is, you know, it's interesting for the genre, I suppose.
There's a place for it, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
To be honest, I might have to wait for it to go on streaming because there's not tons of showing times near me, which probably says quite a lot about how well they think it would do. But yeah, so I can't really tell whether you're recommending it or not.
I recommend it for you because you quite liked Nobody, and mm-hmm. I think that this is of that similar theme, similar type of film, where I think you would appreciate it. I think I wouldn't say that the action sequences are in Nobody. I think were quite tight and quite well choreographed. I think these aren't as well choreographed, but still fairly entertaining.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, to be honest, I didn't have like massive expectations for it anyway. The trailer is blatantly corny.
Yeah.
You know, there's because like season's beatings, you know, like it's very tongue in cheek and but yeah, I will give it a go.
Yeah, give it a try.
What would you give it out of 10?
Like a 6.5, yeah. Probably like 6.5.
Oh, okay, well, that's probably higher than I thought you were going to go.
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. I can't say I didn't enjoy it. I enjoyed parts of it, but there obviously are parts where I was a bit like, but yeah, decent.
I want
to... Sorry.
I want to talk about Bones and All.
Mm.
How likely are you to see this?
I probably won't go see it, to be honest, but I've heard pretty good things about it, but.
Okay. So do you mind if I go into detail?
No, go for it.
Okay. So this is the latest film from Luca Guadagnino, who most recently has done Call Me By Your Name, which featured Timothy Chalamet, as does this, and, the remake of Suspiria, neither of which I've seen. But this is, it's a really odd film.
Mm.
It's a romantic coming of age cannibal road film. Is
okay.
Probably the most easy way for me to describe it. So we start with it's set in like the 80s, I think. It's got that aesthetic as well. So as well as the music, it's kind of got that like a grainy texture to it. Like you look at it and go, oh, okay, this is 70s or 80s. We follow Marin, played by Taylor Russell, who was in, the Escape Room films. She's like 18. She's like a bit of a social loner. Her dad won't let her do very much, go out, see friends, but she sneaks out, goes to this slumber party, and ends up biting off this girl's finger and eating it. She then like runs away, and her dad's like, oh, for fuck's sake, not again. And he's like, we've got to leave, you've got to go before the cops come. So they have to move house again, and then he leaves her during the night and leaves her this like tape recording. Of like, you know, but which we get sporadically throughout the film, snippets off. So he's like, you know, the first time you did it, you were three, you ate a babysitter and all this, and, you know, and so we had to move and your mum ran away and all this sort of stuff. So you kind of get a bit more about that throughout the film. But he also gives her birth certificate, and so she finds out who her mum is and where she is. So she, like, tries to find her essentially, and it's like a cross country, so they're in Maryland, I think, in the northeast, and she's in, her mum is in Missouri, which I have no idea, that's like Central America, I think, center of America, if that makes sense. So she gets on like a Greyhound bus, is basically journeying through America to try and find her mum. On the way, she meets a guy called Sully, played by Mark Rylance, who's another eater, as they call themselves, and he sniffs her out and is like, oh, you're an eater as well, I can smell you, you must be hungry, I can smell that you've not eaten for a while, which what? Is weird in itself. Yeah. So he kind of, he's a lot older than her. She also looks a lot younger than she is. Mm. And he's like, yeah, tries to take her under his wing. He essentially prepares a meal for her. He's like, oh, I can smell this woman's about to die, so, you know, we'll eat her once she dies, because he doesn't kill people, which is, you know, his moral compass. So yeah, so they share this old lady once she passes away.
How can you smell that she's about to die?
He's just got like a heightened sense of smell from being an eater.
Is this like a fantasy film, or is it like supposed to be realistic?
It's kind of present, it's very matter of fact.
Okay.
It's, you know, there's not really any backstory about why there are eaters, you know, or anything like that. Mm. All you're kind of given is that they eat human flesh. They have a compulsion to do that.
And in this world, so do people condemn them for being cannibals or what?
No one seems to know that it's a thing.
Okay.
So they're kind of living in secret.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's like people will go missing rather than everyone knowing that there's these kind of like living zombies, essentially. Mm. But yeah, so there's not much kind of detail given. It's just like these people are a thing, and they have their own, they decide their own kind of moral code, I guess. And Marin's very much like, yeah, I don't want to kill people either. I'll just eat those that are dead. Although she does eat her, that girl's finger. But anyway, so yeah, so Sully kind of is quite intense. Like Mark Rylance is a good actor, and he portrays it in a very strange way, creepy. She ends up running away from him. Then encounters Leon, who is played by Timothée Chalamet, who's about the same age. And the first thing she like kind of says when she meets him is, "Oh, I am 18." He's like, "Okay, cool." Which I think is weird in itself. But anyway, so like she kind of wants to hang around with him. He's an eater. They can smell each other, that they're eaters. Yeah, it's a thing. So they kind of begin journeying together. He's run away from his family because he ate his dad.
Did he kill his dad?
Yeah, his dad was an arsehole, but yeah. Okay. Killed him and then ate him. So they journey together. They encounter a couple of other eaters. All the encounters with other eaters are very odd, like intense. I think that's on purpose. But yeah, but it's got that very like romantic tone to it as well. So like Taylor Russell and Timothée Chalamet have quite good chemistry. Mm. And then the soundtrack is very much kind of cueing you to feel that there's romance there. So it's like acoustic guitar and like strings and stuff. Mm. But it's just with this grisly kind of overtone to it. Mm. And then, yeah, so she encounters her mum. Her mum has bitten off both of her arms.
Her mum bit off her own arms?
Yeah, to kind of try and stop her from hurting anyone else. And she's in an asylum. And then she tries to kill her daughter because...
With no arms?
Yeah, she just tries to, like, eat her. When you explain it, it sounds ridiculous. And it is ridiculous, but it's not funny when you're watching it. But yeah, so it's basically this, like, meandering through America... with Lee and Marin falling in love, and then just that's kind of it. Like then they kind of try and have so she finds her mum like halfway through, that doesn't work out, then they just kind of carry on. They split apart for a bit but come back, and then they go like, oh, let's just try and be normal people. So they get like an apartment and job, and then Sully comes back. And oh, he does come back at another point as well. Marin's like, oh, what, did you see me as a daughter? And he was like, and he does this like weird like thing. And it's like, oh no, okay. It wasn't a father-daughter relationship that he wanted. But yeah, so he gets pissed off that she doesn't want to be with him. Then he comes back right at the end. It tries to like assault her, and then Lee comes back and kills him, but he gets injured and dies as well. And Lee's like, eat me right before I die. And then it ends. It's weird.
It sounds weird.
Very weird. It's not gratuitous, if that makes sense. Like, you do see them kind of eating a little, but it's not prolonged. It's cut, they cut away quite quickly, and the focus is on the romance and the kind of road movie style of it. So it's just weird that this is the setting that it is. It's based on a book, so I don't know what the author was thinking when they wrote this. But yeah, so I mean, it was fine. Like, there is it is weirdly romantic in places. And like I said, the main characters have got quite good chemistry. I don't think they necessarily needed someone like Sully to come back, because that felt like quite abrupt, and then it's over, and then it just felt like a plot device for Lee to end up dying, for it to be like tragic. And then there's only two other eaters that they encounter, and that was a weird kind of encounter, and then they don't come back. So it felt like meandering. It was just like, yeah, this happens, you know, very much like a series of events that occur rather than it being like a cohesive story. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know whether I enjoyed it. It was interesting in the sense of like the mashup of genres and it just being presented so matter-of-factly.
Mm.
Yeah.
How was the acting?
Yeah, it was pretty good. I mean, Mark Rylance is sinister and creepy and like childish at the same time. Taylor Russell and Timothy Chalamet, you know, they're fine. Mm. It's a weird one to quantify.
Fair enough. I mean, yeah, based on what you said to me, I'm not gonna go watch this film.
I didn't necessarily think it would be your sort.
Yeah, not because it sounds bad, but just because it just doesn't seem like it's up my alley, really.
No. Yeah, very, very strange. And actually, it's an 18, but, like, although, despite everything I've just said, it's kind of a soft 18, because, like, much of the violence is not really... I mean, it's shown, but not prolonged. And something like a John Wick, which they're all 15s, like, they're really violent.
Mm.
So I wonder, like, whether it's the tone, because the tone of this is like, yeah, this happens, you know.
It's kind of, I think that's probably, you know, an automatic 15, if you're talking about eating people. And then obviously,
yeah, the rest of it. 15, fine, but anyway, so it's just interesting. Yeah, so that was Bones and All. Anything else you want to review before we wrap up?
No, I don't think so, you know. I think I'm all tapped out. I'm going to start watching Willow. I don't know if you've seen the Willow TV show dropped on Disney Plus, the first two episodes, but I haven't seen the original film, so I'm going to watch that and then start giving my weekly reviews on that. But apart from that, that's it, really. I don't think there's much coming. I think it's pretty cool. Well, apart from Avatar, obviously, I think it's pretty quiet for the next couple of weeks as well.
Yeah, I think it's gonna. That's just gonna dominate the screens, isn't it?
Mm. I read a thing I read a thing that I know you have to remind me how like fucking budgets work and stuff, because I read a thing saying that Avatar's gonna have to make $2 billion in order for it to break even. That can't be right, surely.
Well, yeah. I mean, let me try and see if what the I'll try and find out what the budget of it was. So it's saying the budget is 350 to 400 million.
Okay.
Although it's weird because they filmed 2.5 of them back to back. So they built sets for like, I don't know, whatever it was, like, you know, the beach location. And they were like, okay, well, we're going to use this for these scenes in the second film, these scenes in the third film, and this scene in the fourth film.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just, rather than dismantling them and rebuilding them each time, they kind of just shot all of those scenes at the time. So it's going to be difficult to ascertain how much budget to give to each of those films, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the, like with the Rings of Power, a lot of that budget is the upfront building costs and that sort of thing. So I think the budget for the Rings of Power first one is like over 400 million, but subsequent ones will reuse those sets type thing. Right. So, but this is saying 350 to 400 million. They're going to do at least the same amount in, marketing of the film.
Yeah.
So you're already close to a billion there. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of creative accounting that goes on, I'm sure, because there's films like some actors will have a back end percentage deal, so like when a film makes profit they get a percentage of the profit, and so there's some films, I can't remember off the top of my head, but they're like wildly successful films that on paper have never made a profit, because if they have, then it means their lead actor is entitled to, you know, some money.
Right.
So yeah, $2 billion sounds high, but I mean take into account like how much this is marketed, how much they're blocking out screens and stuff. Like, it's probably not too far off. I don't even know if I'm looking forward to it, to be honest.
Do you know what? I am, only because I just want to see what James Cameron's been cooking for the past 13 years. I want to see if it's worth the hype that I feel like he has put upon this film. And I think, was it, I might have been him to be fair, who was chatting shit about the MCU. Was that him or was that someone else?
No, that was Scorsese and Tarantino, I think.
Okay, fair enough. But yeah, with this one, I feel like I'm being a bit harsh on the Avatar first film. I think it's fine. I think obviously visually it's great, but I think I've built up in my head that like, oh, it's so overrated, it's rubbish, da, da, da. So I'm trying to go into this one and be more like level headed with it and not go into it thinking, oh, it's going to be overrated. Let me see for myself if I actually like enjoy this film, and it's hopefully, as well as being visually stunning, hopefully it is also a compelling story, hopefully, but we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, fair. I mean, yeah, I'm going to watch it, but...
Of course. Are you watching in 3D?
Probably not. I didn't watch the first one in 3D.
No, I think I did. I might watch this one in 3D. But then it is 3 hours long, so I feel like I might... I don't know.
Yeah, it's 3 hours 12 or something.
Woof, that is a long film.
And also, the film, you've probably seen a trailer for it, Babylon, that's 3 hours 10.
Yeah, that film, I'm watching that film, I'm thinking, what the fuck is this about? Like, I don't get that film. I'm going to watch it, but I have, like, no desire to watch it. That makes sense. Like,
it's kind of one of those films that I'm like, someone scored. Mbappe again. Like, it kind of just seems like they're trying to just, oh, let's just make a really hedonistic film.
Mm.
Like, let's put people, like, doing drugs and swearing and sex and fighting snakes. Like, yeah, let's just, oh, it's just a mad film. And, like, it's either going to be really good or, like, really shit,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, agreed.
But, yeah, so we'll kind of come to that when it's out. I feel like, as we are now in December, we should forecast a end of year review for the coming weeks.
I feel like, do you know what? I need to think back, but I feel like this year's been kind of disappointing for films.
Mm.
I'm trying to think of films that I've loved. I can't think of one that I've loved.
I think that they might have been front-loaded at the beginning of the year. But yeah, so we will do that. We'll try and get Chris, we'll try and lock him down for the pod. But please do send in your thoughts, if you're listening, for what you've enjoyed most this year, content wise, whether it's film, TV, special. do tweet us at YSC Podcast 17 or, DM us on Instagram at Your Average Critics.
Keep it sexy.
All right. Peace.